This is KTOO in Juneau. Stay tuned for Juneau Afternoon. We'll be talking with Kyle Wiley Pickett about his years as the music director and conductor of the Juneau Symphony. J. Kevin Birchfield will be here to highlight his new novel, Jingle Jingle, and we'll continue our Fish 101 series with Tom Rutecki from the National Marine Fisheries Service Auk Bay Lab. Our weather, partly cloudy today, highs around 60. It's gorgeous out right now. Tonight, partly cloudy. And then Thursday through Friday, increasing clouds, highs still around 60 though. Friday night, cloudy again, and rain is likely Saturday through Monday. And welcome to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Laurie Scandling, and with me is Jeff Brown. Our first guest today is Kyle Wiley Pickett, who for 14 years has been the music director and conductor of the Juneau Symphony. And it's interesting, someone said to me not long ago, what Kyle did was turn what was a community orchestra into a symphony.
Well, that's a very nice way to say that.
So what brought you to Little Juneau, Alaska? You were from down south.
Yeah, I'm from down south. I'm originally from the Bay Area in California. And I'd been in Baltimore, Maryland, doing grad school. And then my wife and I moved out to Oregon. And while I was doing my dissertation, she was working for the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And, you know, I was looking for a job. I didn't have one. And the way you look for a job as a conductor, that's why we pay our dues to the Conductors Guild, so that we get our monthly job bulletin. And there aren't that many symphony jobs open every year. In fact, there are very few symphony jobs open every year. And I remember really vividly, actually, picking up the job bulletin, looking at it, and saying, Juneau, Alaska, should I apply here? And my wife said, you don't have a job, you should apply everywhere. And so I sent my materials off, and I remember very vividly getting the phone call, too. I got a message on our answering machine. It was Catherine Kurtz, who was leading the search and still plays in the Juneau Symphony. And she left a message saying, you know, this is Catherine Kurtz with the Juneau Symphony, and we'd like to interview you. And I said, oh, huh. And my wife said, what are you waiting for? Call them back. So I called back, and we set up an interview time and did the interview, and then got a call, you know, a few weeks later saying, you know, we'd love for you to come up and be one of our candidates. And at that time, the symphony had started the search mid-year, because when Mel Flood left and they made a transition, you know, it happened very suddenly, very quickly, and so Gordon Wright had come down and conducted a couple concerts, and they started the search, and they said, this was in January, they said, are you available? Catherine said, are you available in April? And I was available, because I didn't have a job yet, so came up for the whole month and did my candidate concert, and then the rest, as they say, sort of fell into place and was history.
Kyle, how old are you?
I'm 42.
So you got here when you were 28 years
28.
Old. Golly,
yeah.
It seems like perhaps you've grown up as a conductor with Juneau, as it's grown with
absolutely,
you.
Absolutely, no question. I have grown up as a conductor with Juneau. Yeah.
What do you think you learned most about being a conductor, particularly in a small community that is arts-rich and enthusiastic?
You know, I've done a lot of traveling in the last couple of years, conducting all over, and people ask me, pretty frequently, they say, you know, because a lot of people from throughout the country have taken the cruises through Southeast, and, you know, so they'll stop in Juneau for a few hours along that cruise, and then people say, there's an orchestra in Juneau? And I get the opportunity to brag about this community and say, yeah, of course there's an orchestra, there's a student symphony, there are two opera companies, there are a multitude of theater companies, there's a state museum, there are amazing arts that happen here in this little town. And I've often said, you know, there are bigger towns, there are bigger symphonies, but there are probably not very many places where you'll have a more enthusiastic and supportive audience than you have here in Juneau. And as to what I learned, well, I mean, an immeasurable, it's probably impossible to even quantify because, like you said, I was 28 years old. It was really, you know, along with what happened in California. I mean, my job in California, my job in Juneau happened really right at the same time. And so that was the beginning of my career right then in 2000. And so, you know, every concert I do, every piece I play has been a learning experience for me as well as for the orchestra. But I don't think that'll ever stop. And in some ways, that's one of the most important lessons, is that as a musician, as a performer, you're constantly learning. You have to be constantly learning. I think when you stop learning, it's time to give it up. Because really, one of the great joys of being a conductor is that I get to spend a lot of time with some of the greatest geniuses who've ever lived, you know, greatest artistic geniuses, and that's Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms and Mahler and Shostakovich and Copland and so
welcome.
Forth.
Oh,
yeah.
How are you, Lisa? Well, we're going to have some other people talk about your experience as well.
Okay.
And it's Lisa Ibias, is that right?
That's correct.
Well, welcome. And you are the concert master. Is that the right title, Lisa?
We use that term.
Sometimes they call me the concert shyster.
Well, we're glad to have you here. Please tell us a little bit about your memories of Kyle and something that...
This is your life? Is that what's
happening? This is your life, Kyle.
This is my
just
life
wait.
In
We've got your 6-year-old babysitter coming in from when you were, preschooler. So, Lisa, tell us what you'd like us to remember about Kyle.
Well, I don't know if Kyle remembers, but when he started with the symphony, my children were the same age as his are now.
That's right. I do remember that.
And I remember going, every once in a while, going, man, I can't wait till Kyle has kids. Then he'll understand my predicament.
That's right. We used to run rehearsals, every rehearsal till 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, he got there and he changed our rehearsal schedule, and I was thinking, oh, my God, I'm trying to build my business. I was working, 10, 11-hour days, and raising two young children at the time.
How old are your kids now, Kyle? You have two sons, right?
Two sons, 4 and 7.
Oh.
Yeah. See this gray hair right there? That's not because of Juno's symphony.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, I was just asking Kyle how he had grown during the 14 years with Juno. How do you think the symphony has grown?
It's grown in leaps and bounds. I mean, it's just changed so drastically. I remember I started with the symphony in 1982. And we played the commencement at UAS. Oh man, we did some gigs. And it's nice. It's really nice to actually play like a real symphony. And it was a real symphony back then, but now it's like an actual symphony. And we play real works, the actual written. We don't just play arrangements.
I think it was someone asked me this the other day, and I think one of the things that transitioned very quickly on when I took over, I think prior to my coming here, it's probably fair to say that the orchestra, I mean, it was always an orchestra. I mean, it's kind of, we just had the 50th anniversary. It's been here for a long time. But I think before I came along, it might be fair to say that the orchestra existed mostly as an institution to let local people get together and play. And then we really became an orchestra that was for the community to come and listen to. And that takes a shift in thinking, a shift in our attitude about the way we perform. I mean, it still, of course, is for us as well, but it's also for the audience.
Wonderful. Well, yeah. We have another symphony member and storyteller. Thank you, Lisa.
All right. Thanks for having me.
And Bob King is here. Bob, yeah. Why don't you step to the microphone?
Yeah, thanks. And, actually, this is it's great to be able to, send Kyle off to thank him for all his. I remember the first concert when we were auditioning the different conductors, and he did Beethoven 5.
We did.
And it was really, I remember after that concert, all the musicians looking around at each other, it's like, we did that? Because you pushed us. You pushed us on the tempos, and you really drove us, and we really knew that there was a really a sound. And over the years, I mean, just your friendship, your work, your the pre-concert lectures, the talk, the talks, just sort of explaining the music. Actually, I always thought that was the one thing that the audience always missed was one of the great things about your rehearsals was you always sort of talked about the background and the stories and the history behind all of that, and you gave that for the people who came early. Those pre-concert talks, they were just really, really, really good and really important. But
so it sounds like the players learned a lot about what they were playing.
Oh, yeah.
What do you play, Bob?
Violin.
Okay.
You know, I'm a very mediocre violinist, and to be able to have the platform with all the other great violinists that we do have, and to see the growth, to see actually, you know, like the rehearsal last night, see how many young musicians were there. I was there with a high school player who was really, really, really good.
Yeah, really good.
I just really impressed with the talent and fostering those that type of introduction in there. And also, you know, one thing I think that you really did great that I just wanted to mention, because as much as I love the classics and I love the Beethoven and the Brahms and all that, you really went out of your way during the past 15 years to introduce, I mean, new music, like Harbison.
The
Great Gatsby.
That's right.
Lowell Lieberman, Hovhaannes, Phil Munger, Nino Rota. Schwander, the concertos for maracas and djembe.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. We did.
You know, I thought a concerto for maracas. I mean, what's this all about?
Yeah, that was pretty fun.
But it turned out to be great. And the last thing I'll just mention was recognizing that in the state library there was a piece of music that had sat for years and years, a score of an Alaska symphony written by a New York composer named Wilson Sawyer, who nobody ever heard of. But the score was there in the state archives. Pulled that out, took a lot of work to get it into shape.
Bob pulled that out. Bob found it.
No, I didn't find it. But
you did pull it out.
We did a lot of the work and the like. But putting that together and giving this work, a work written about Alaska, its world premiere 30 years after the composer had died, was a real treat.
Yeah, that was pretty neat.
History making.
You know? And it might not be a war horse, you know, in the long run, but I think it meant a lot for Alaska and for like. So, I mean, thanks for all your work and dedication.
Thank you very much.
We really appreciate it.
Well, that was Bob King. Thank you so much, Bob, for dropping by. And the next Bob is in line. Bob Helm. Welcome, Bob.
Hi. This is Bob Helm. Call it my favorite Kyle moment. There's actually two. One was the first time that he and Alice came to stay with Marie and I and brought along Max. And they came and put Max down, and he kind of trotted around the house, came back and said, "Yeah, looks fine to me." And then popped himself onto the couch and settled in like he owned the place. And the second one is when I won the bid for conducting the orchestra, and he was giving me conducting lessons. I still have the baton he gave me, and he still owes me a signature on it.
Well, that was Bob Helm giving his good wishes. And Franz Felkel is in the studio. He's one of the younger members of the symphony. Franz, I've seen you play, I think, probably since you were in high school.
Yeah.
You're a violinist, and welcome. Glad to have you here to help us celebrate
Kyle. Thank you.
Kyle.
I'm absolutely glad to be here.
And I want to point out, Franz is no longer one of the youngest members of the orchestra, but was the youngest member of the orchestra that we've ever had.
How old are you now, Franz?
I'm 23. I first had a chance to play with Kyle in the symphony when I was 12.
Yeah.
I won the youth concerto competition the first time when I was 12, and I got to play solo with them. And then Kyle said, "Come on, join us." And now I just got my bachelor's in music education, and one of the greatest things that I learned about a year and a half ago, we played a Brahms symphony.
Yeah.
And my advisor up at UAF also plays bass in the symphony here as well. And I was taking a class from him, and we were talking about sequencing and teaching. And we get here, and we get to the first rehearsal, and Kyle starts the first movement, and he goes through the first page in an incredibly impressive educator to the orchestra. And I don't think it was until that point that I realized how much that you have actually taught me through the 10, 11 years I've been with the symphony. It was amazing just seeing you work with the orchestra and those new types and those new eyes that I have. And
Thanks, Franz.
It was amazing.
And, you know, I want to point out Franz. I mean, we got to watch Franz grow up as a musician, which was really exciting. And, you know, I was one of the things I was really proud of was by the time you went to UAF, you'd already played a whole lot of major repertoire
with
the orchestra.
Yeah, I just applied for master's programs, and I went through. I had to put a rep list together, and I just went on the Juno Symphony, and I think that's part of the reason. I got to play so much repertoire at such a young age. It was an incredible opportunity. I thank Kyle for that.
Well, our theme has been growing up as a musician, and you have literally done that.
Half his life.
Under Kyle's leadership. Well, we have another recorded message. Thank you, Franz.
Hi, this is children's musician Dr. Noyes. My favorite maestro Kyle moment is when we were both hiking in Juneau, and Kyle saved me from a wild bear attack by fighting the creature off with his bare hands just as it was about to eat me, and then singing it a beautiful lullaby until the bear fell peaceably asleep. I mean, that's just Kyle. Okay, that didn't happen, but I just wanted the maestro to sound really heroic. Actually, there are two reasons Kyle is one of my heroes: his desire to connect with people and his work ethic. The stereotypical conductor is aloof and intellectual, but Kyle is far from intellectual. Wait, that came out wrong. What I mean to say is that Kyle is a conductor who loves connecting with people and is real and human in his connections, not bombastic. For Dr. Noyes Symphony Show, that means Kyle is the conductor who's willing to sing goofy songs, crack silly jokes for his audience, wear ridiculous things on stage, and dance like a crazy man with me to get the kids engaged in orchestral music. And he's the conductor who goes out to pizza with the orchestra after. His work ethic is fairly legendary as he flies from state to state, giving his all to every concert. And I think it's just great that he's made such a name for himself as a conductor after his professional football career was abruptly and sadly cut short. But mostly, I wanted to tell you about how he saved me from the bear. Have a good show, Maestro.
Well, the NFL loss was our gain. And welcome to Tom Melville, another Juno Symphony member. Tom, what is your instrument?
Well, I'm actually a member of the chorus.
Oh, and very nice.
One of the great things about being a member of the chorus is that in most choral works, there are periods when there are soloists or the orchestra is playing, and we just get to sit there and watch. And most notably, and of course, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, we get to watch for a good long time.
Yeah, good long time.
Sounds like something that would be pretty boring, especially, you know, the second concert in a day. But in fact, the opportunity to watch Kyle from that side of the podium conducting the orchestra was just an amazing experience that I wish all the members of the audience would be able to have, especially when his cummerbund starts to fail in the middle of the Ninth Symphony, his shirt starts pouring out all over the place, and we're waiting for his pants to fall down and wondering how this is all going to end. So a memorable costume failure in the middle of Beethoven's Ninth, but Kyle just went right through it like there was no problem at all, because there was no problem at all. But he switched to a vest
shortly thereafter. Well, our next message is from Jetta Whitaker, former executive director of the Juno Symphony.
This is Allison Brown. I was lucky to have Kyle and his family stay at the house for 2 weeks each time they came to Juno for concerts over a period of...
Hi, this is Jetta Whitaker, and my favorite Kyle moment is Kyle having enough faith in me to program the Brahms Violin Concerto last season, as it contains a beautiful and terrifying oboe solo. But we did it. Thanks.
This is Allison Brown. I was lucky to have Kyle and his family stay at the house for 2 weeks each time they came to Juno for concerts over a period of 12 years or so. And following a Saturday night concert during his first or second year, we tried to think of ways to increase concert attendance. I told him there were many other music aficionados in Juno, who attend concerts featuring country, western, pop, and jazz music. He said the symphony could play lighter, but still classical music with those themes, which might bring in those audiences. In a few more minutes, the idea of the symphony's annual Pops concert was born. The Pops concerts did attract new audiences, and their appreciation of classical music grew, and they began attending the other concerts during the symphony's season. Kyle's been such an inventive, forward-thinking musical director and such a great communicator. He's going to be missed by so many, and I'm grateful for their having been here and thrilled for their future.
Welcome to Sally Smith, who's now here in the studio to share her thoughts.
I'm actually here, Kyle, with Rich Ritter, so because we thought that the percussion section should just double-team you. But you want to tell the joke
first? Yeah, before we start.
Oh, great. Rich has the joke.
Yes. What do you call someone who hangs out with musicians?
What's that?
A percussionist.
That's very good.
And here we are. So we got to hang out with you, the real musician, and I want to thank you for your tolerance of someone who is kind of a part-time show up and play. I remember your surprise when I played the cymbals on the 1812 Overture, and I got it right.
I wasn't surprised.
But then there was your surprise when I missed the bass drum beat on Beethoven's Ninth.
Might have been surprised on
and
that
I'm
one.
And I'm so sorry for that. But I have always appreciated your tolerance and your encouragement and
your
willingness to stand by those of us who couldn't play all the time. It's
thank
been
you.
A wonderful ride.
Thanks so much.
I remember we were rehearsing a ridiculously hard piece, which I know was a surprise. You seldom did that.
And, that's the next joke.
You stopped us and you said, look, you're getting too stressed out about the notes. Don't worry about the notes. We're trying to make great music. Just worry about the music and relax. So we played about 10 measures and you stopped us again. And you said, okay, that was pretty good, but you've got to worry about some of the notes.
Yeah, I think I remember that too.
But it goes to show your relaxed touch with a orchestra that's mostly volunteers, a few professional types, and just a grace under fire. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rich.
Lovely.
This is Lucas Hoyland, and my favorite Kyle moment probably really isn't just one single moment. I think the awesomest thing about Kyle is that he always had his hands in stuff. He was always there willing to do whatever needed to be done. Specifically, I guess, when we were building the clouds, the acoustical shells that hang during the concerts, he was right there with us, building them, you know, during the construction phase. He was right there up on the cherry picker painting the wall one time when it needed to get painted for one concert or another. Congratulations, Kyle, and break a leg this weekend.
That was Lucas Hoyland. And with us live in the studio is Marta Lestufka, who doesn't play an instrument, but she's here to share her voice with us.
Did you come here for a pie, Seth? I brought meat pies because I thought Kyle must be getting exhausted with all this love he's been showered with. I just wanted to talk really quickly about became a fan of Kyle's in Degrees, and these are the three highlights. The first was his audition concert, which was a great concert, but what was evident was the symphony's affection and faith in him, and we as an audience really felt that. It was very exciting, and over the years that has just proved that that faith was well-founded. The second one was Sweeney Todd, which guiled an enormous risk on me. It was a mountain of a production, and I think what most people don't realize is how quickly Kyle puts together these concerts that, unfortunately, in our culture, conductors are transient. They have to make a lot of homes, and they have a really short amount of time to put a symphony concert together, and it's a huge feat. But going through that 2 weeks Kyle was terrifying and extraordinary, and one of the things I'm most proud of, and the one thing I know is I never, ever could have done it without Kyle's direction. the third time that I fell in love with him to a greater degree was at the youth solo competition last year. And that's happening again tonight, where young musicians play in Juno in a competition for the privilege of performing with the symphony. But Kyle treats those young musicians with so much respect and affection and sympathy, and takes that opportunity to really teach them about the wider world and the path that they are embarking on. And it's very moving, and I encourage everybody to come tonight to hear those young musicians. But Kyle,
thanks, Martha.
Thank you. Good luck. We're going to miss you. Oh. Eat.
We'll eat the meat pies while we hear from our next well-wisher, Julia Bastischek.
Hi, this is Julia Bastischek, and I'm calling from Bend, Oregon. And I was trying to just pick one of my favorite moments with Kyle, and it was really hard because they've all been great. And I just want to thank him so much for all the music we've been playing over the years. And I really feel like I'm a much better musician since working with Kyle. And every time we play a concert, I come back with something that's going to help my own playing or something I can share with my students to make them better. And I really appreciate it. So thanks, Kyle. All the best. It's been really fun. Oh, and if there was one particular moment, I think it would have to be when you allowed Nathan to play the contrabassoon part for Beethoven 5 on the tuba. We still crack up every time we hear that CD.
Bruce Simonson has joined us as well. Welcome, Bruce.
Hey, nice to be here. Hey, Kyle.
Hey, Bruce.
Surprise, anyway.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I have two quick ones. The first one is the very first rehearsal where we did Beethoven 5 and we did the scherzo, and, oh, my God, the cellos and the violas have to do some tough stuff here.
Yeah.
And I remember you working with them, and I don't know who was more nervous, if it was us or you, because you were auditioning and had to do this
well. Yeah, a little bit of both.
And then the second time through, well, let's try it again, and we kind of knew what it was up against. And then the third time was, okay, we'll take a little slower, and Kyle said, that's stuff you can work on. And everybody at the end of that felt good about, well, we have some work to do, but we can do it. So that was the very first rehearsal. And then I want to flash forward about 14 years when we did Beethoven 9 rehearsal, the dress rehearsal for Beethoven 9 on the stage instead of in the band room. And I think that was a three-hour rehearsal, but it felt like 30 minutes. It was amazing. You had so many wonderful, great ideas, and everybody was just flowing with it and featured every group, like, oh, here's the time where the chorus gets to sing Zeitumschlungen and all this stuff that you had prepared and just idea after idea. And I just said to myself, well, this is what happens when you have a really talented guy that knows how to do rehearsals. And that's the rehearsal side of things, and people who hear these performances really know what's going on, too. But I think probably the main thing I would say is that I think, for me personally, you really inspired me to play better than I ever thought I could, and let me do repertoire that I never thought I'd have the opportunity for. And so, and that's the musician side of things. And, of course, Kyle and your family are just wonderful friends. So
thanks, Bruce.
So you can't go, by the way. We're going to chain you to this room, but so you're stuck here. Anyway, it's wonderful, Kyle. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.
What a lovely legacy. We have another electronic message, this one from Susan Fitzgerald.
Hi, this is Susan Fitzgerald. Leaving Juno for sunnier skies was hard to do, and one of the hardest things to leave behind was a community whose commitment to the arts was so strong. One of my fondest memories of my years doing a Juno afternoon is all of those pre-concert interviews I did with you, Kyle. You were such a great guest, always prepared with fascinating insights into the composers and the music. You made the music exciting, real, and accessible for everyone. Best of luck in your new positions.
And we're back live in the studio. Kristen Garreau is here. Kristen, what instrument do you play?
I play the violin.
Listen, after witnessing these testimonials today, I think I need to learn to play music.
This has been
a love fest.
We've got a student symphony.
It is.
Well, welcome, Kristen.
Thank you. I had to come here because I started playing with the symphony once Kyle started with the symphony. Our concert that we're playing this weekend was also my first concert.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's just been this really cool journey that I feel like we've been on together. And as you've professionally grown and I've professionally grown in my non-musical profession and just sort of our parallel lives and our friendship, and it's just awesome. And I'm so happy.
Thanks for
coming. And sad to see you leave, but excited.
You know, a lot of these people who've been in here today are also people who have opened up their homes to us. We've stayed in about 36, 38 homes when we've been here in Juneau. And I'll just say one thing about Kristen. I didn't know Kristen very well when she was gone, and she said, you can stay in our house. And I remember looking at her bookshelf, and they were all the same books that I had. And we thought, okay, I called my wife and said, we've got to get to know Kristen because we have all the same books. So, we clearly will be friends.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming by.
Thanks,
Kristen.
Thanks.
We do have someone live on the line who's going to share their thoughts with you as well, and that's Andrew Shermer.
Hi, Kyle. Hi, everybody. I would say I don't have several memories in particular. I don't know if I'd share them on the air, but overall, I just think of those great three-hour rehearsals the last 15 years, where you manage to constantly keep the orchestra challenged and really bring the Juneau Symphony to the level that it is today. And my first concert was in 1999, and just the level of growth that you still have under your baton, I think it's worth saying, worth recognizing. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Andrew, for giving us a call and sharing your thoughts with Kyle today. And our last live guest is Roald Simonsen. Welcome.
Hi.
Hey, Roald.
Hello, Kyle. I'm going to talk about briefly about our projects that we've done together, this idea that you had when you came up here. And I joined you up here a year or two later, and you said, let's do some film and music projects. And you came up with ideas for a piece of music, and I would take photographs and video and put them together to music, and then we'd project that on the screen, and then the orchestra would play along with it. And, of course, the difficulty was you had to be in sync with this video that was going on. And when it works, of course, it's just magic. And when it doesn't exactly work, it sort of is appropriate background music. But early on, before we developed our technique and perfected how to be in sync all the time, which we will patent and let know, but early on, we had these ad hoc ways where I would operate the video projector so that it would, like, stop and the music would catch up, or I'd go in reverse at certain moments. And we did the Ferdy Groffet Grand Canyon Suite that we did for the anniversary of SEAC, I guess.
Yeah.
That was a longer piece, so it was even harder to keep that in sync the whole time. And I remember, and I got mixed up. I went backwards and forth, you know, in the audience. I don't know what they were thinking. But then there's finally settled on this beautiful image. I think maybe Skip Gray provided as like a fishing boat in the golden sunset going towards the Chilkat Mountains. Just beautiful, beautiful. And I'm there, but we're so far off that on the slow close-up I'm doing of it, it's the storm sequence.
From the Groffet, from Grand Canyon, that's right.
So it's just like, it's crazy. And then I think I just kind of shut it off.
I think that you said, I wonder what the audience is thinking. We think it's creative. We don't know the difference.
Right.
We assume it's all intended.
But and I'm going to just say one little other short one, too, because famously, I mean, I don't know, we've done 6 or 8 of these projects here and down south in your California orchestra, but our town, there was one where I did a long, slow fade-out on the last image, and we were working on it and got it right, and somehow it was especially long, and I could see you working the orchestra to just kind of slow it down, and then play it, and then just hold this music and music, and it was like a beautiful moment, and just a long, 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 slow fade out, and then it was gone. And that's sort of what's going on here.
I was
going
to say, it feels very appropriate for this moment. Kind of a long fade out.
A long fade out.
Yeah.
And then the moment.
Thanks, Roald.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming.
So stay on Facebook. And I'll see you in Missouri at some point.
Thank you. Well, thanks. It's clear you are loved both personally and professionally here, Kyle. And
this was your time, and I guess this is the fade out.
Well, thank you. That was a really lovely surprise. I appreciate that.
Well, we're glad that we could have these folks share with you their appreciation. And if there is any last thought for this moment, now's the moment.
Well, I'm not gone yet. We still have 2 weeks here in a concert, two big concerts, and we're soaking up every minute of it. We will always be back. You know, this has been our second home since, you know, really 1999, and my kids have, you know, grown up here as well as in California, and we will always be back.
Thanks, Kyle. We wish you well.
Thank you.
All right. And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling. My engineer today, as always at my side, Jeff Brown. Our next guest is Kevin Birchfield, who has written his third novel based in beautiful Juno. This one's called Jingle Jingle. Kevin, I have to say I've never read a book quite like this. What was your inspiration? And maybe you want to talk a little bit about where your ideas come from.
Well, I love to write about Juno because I love Juno. I absolutely love it. I've been here 18 years. And I like to write about different things. I've got a real dark sense of humor, and I also like to incorporate the things that are in Juno, the buildings, the places, and also the real people that live here too. But I put them in a little odd situations, and that's just kind of what I like to do.
So I'm assuming that one of your main characters, the evil witch, is not based on a real person. How did you come up with the Jingle Jingle idea?
Actually, she is based on a real person. She's a friend of mine. We were road tripping across Colorado this last fall. She and I were driving along together, and everywhere we stopped, she would get out of the car and walk along, and her purse would go jingle, 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 jingle. And that's where the whole idea came for the whole book.
And tell me a little, I haven't read your other two books. This one is has some darkness, some evil, murder of your close friends, actually, in the book. You're laughing as though you get pleasure out of that. Tell me a little bit about how this compares with your other two books.
It's in the same genre. Everything is real similar to the other books. What happened is the first book that I wrote a few years ago, The Great Alaskan Adventure with Zombies, I did the same thing. I incorporated real people. And I just was inundated by my friends saying, hey, kill me in your next book. Come on, kill me in your next book. Put me in your next book. Don't kill me, but, you know, somewhere that way. And I've just got this big, long list of people that want to be in a book. So I just keep going down the list and putting them in
books. And killing your friends.
Killing my friends, and they love me for it.
Now, are you trying to think of, there are a couple of creative ways that people are offed in this novel. Are you laying awake at night trying to think of more unusual ways to end your friend's earthly existence?
I don't lay awake at night, but my wife does, worried about me.
Tell me how long it takes you to write. This book is slender. It's, what do we got here, about 125 pages. What is it in terms of hours and to write the book? And if you really are a captain, you must not write much in the summer. You must be out doing a lot of charters. This must be your busy season.
That is correct. Right now is my busy season, but that does afford me the opportunity to have about 6 months to work on things in the wintertime. And that's exactly what I do. I'm very regimented. I'll get up, have breakfast, go to work on the book. And I'll work for about 3 months on a book, mm-hmm. and working pretty much every day and doing the writes, the rewrites, and what we have to do.
off of whom do you bounce your ideas? And you credit your wife in the book as being a great sounding board. What about some of the friends that you've talked about? And what kind of feedback do you get from them that you might or might not incorporate into your writing?
Well, I bounce a lot of things off my wife, like you mentioned, and she's great. She's real creative also. She's an artist, and she can throw things back at me real well. The main character was based on an individual named Tori, and she and I on that road trip were bouncing ideas back and forth. And I have several friends in town that I like to bounce things off of, but I do it in a real clandestine fashion. I'll just throw things out at a party or something and see what sticks to the wall and if they react to it or if they don't, and that's how I get feedback from them.
So your threshold is what sticks to the wall.
Yes.
I love that. That's kind of an interesting standard by which to write. How do you decide on editing in terms of what to keep in, what to take out? You do get feedback, and then how do you decide whether or not it strengthens or doesn't help the book?
That's where my wife, Cindy, comes in. She is my primary editor, and she her feedback, like I said, she's very creative, and I'll read her every night when she comes in. I read what I've written that day, and how she reacts to it is very important, and sometimes she'll just throw things in there that need to be in there or maybe to clarify things. But she would be my main editor.
So I'm talking with Kevin Birchfield, and his third book is called Jingle Jingle. And the first one was Great Alaska Adventures with Zombies. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the second one?
Full Moon Over Juneau.
Full Moon Over Juneau.
Which was about werewolves.
Why these themes? They're all kind of, they seem like themes that would be, I don't know, I'm a former middle school teacher, that might be, you know, something that middle school kids would be excited about.
When I was growing up, I grew up down south, and there was a late-night horror host that showed these movies on Saturday nights at midnight, and I would stay up and watch them. And I just got hooked to the genre, and I just love those old scary movies.
Are you saying you never got over that eighth-grade urge?
No. But you do know the age of a man. You can tell his real age. Add the two digits together.
Okay. And you are how old?
I'm 49, so I'm really 13.
13. So that works out well.
Yeah.
Now, would you think that this is appropriate for young adults? There's some graphic language and some really graphic situations in there.
I think it would be appropriate for anyone that is, say, high school age and up.
Okay. And how do you market your books, and do you make a living off of them or some part of a living?
I do make a little bit of money from them, but that's really not the point. The point is the creativeness and putting them out there, and just it's very satisfying for me. When you can hold your own book and look at it, it's really satisfying because you know exactly how much work you've put into it.
When was the first book written? Like, over what period of time have you put out the three novels?
I've been writing books for about 8 years now. So it's every 2 or 3 years I put out a new book.
And when you first got started, what was the hardest part about getting started? I mean, your language is very everyday. It's very what one might hear on the street. And while the situations are unusual because they have that kind of creep or spook factor, you do take everyday situations that one might encounter in Juneau. So what was the big challenge when you got started?
The big challenge was just getting started. That's the hardest thing. I talk to so many people that tell me that they want to write a book, or they've been working on one, and then they just put it off, and you just got to do it. That's the hardest thing. And once I had the time to do it, which that started about 8 years ago, then it was a lot easier to just do it.
So, zombies, werewolves, witches. What's next?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe I'll create something new.
All right. Kevin, if you were to recommend this book to someone, what would you tell them in terms of why they would enjoy it?
Well, I think they would enjoy it, especially people in Juneau, because they'll know all the locations. They can set at the Alaskan and say, yeah, I've been there, and I've been to Couch Beach, and yeah, I've seen pallet fires there. Wonder if that really did happen. I think that the characters that they'll know from town too. And it's just a fun read. At least that's what I think. I think it's just a fun romp through town.
It's kind of whimsical,
yeah,
and fanciful. if you don't take it too seriously.
Right.
It could be scary otherwise. Well, thanks for joining us, Kevin. We've been talking with Kevin Birchfield about his third book, Jingle Jingle. I love the illustration on the front. First, I thought it might be about, I don't know, you know, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer or something. But you can get his books at Rainy Day Books downtown.
Yep, Rainy Retreat Books, and they're available at the Jack also.
Very good. Glad to have you with us, Kevin, and wish you well on your charter captaining this summer. I see you've got your sweatshirt on.
Thank you very much.
All right.
The Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 4th of June, 2014, anniversary of the first awarding of the Pulitzer Prizes in 1917 at Columbia University in New York City. 1919, on this day, Congress approved the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. 1973, on this day, George Wetzel registered a patent for the automated teller machine, the ATM. He was the one who developed the ATM card as we know it today, plastic card, magnetic strip, and embedded PIN code. And it's the anniversary of the June 4th incident, otherwise known as Tiananmen Square in Beijing, 1989. Chinese students and intellectuals had begun calling for economic and political reform at a time of great economic growth in China. The general secretary of the Communist Party, Hu Yaobang, had been in favor of a more democratic China, but he was forced out of office in 1987, died in April 1989. And on the day of his funeral, 100,000 students gathered in Tiananmen Square to demand reform. Also in other cities across China, by May, about a million people were demonstrating. The government warned the crowds to disperse. Martial law declared in mid-May. Crowds of protesters blocked all the avenues to the square. The army was unable to get through. So the government massed tanks and heavily armed troops overnight on June the 3rd. And the next morning, June the 4th, they rolled into Tiananmen Square. Most of the protesters fled. The official death toll was 241, 7,000 wounded. Other estimates place the number much higher. It was on this date in 1896, a young engineer, Henry Ford, completed the building and successfully tested his first experimental automobile, which he called the quadricycle. It was on four bicycle tires. He'd been working on it for 2 years out in the shed behind his house on Bagley Avenue in Detroit. It was all ready to test when he discovered it was too wide to go through the door of the workshop, so he had to take an axe to the door frame and the bricks and open up the garage, and soon he was rolling down Grand River Avenue. Two-cycle, four-horsepower engine. It could go up to 20 miles per hour. It had two gears and no brakes, ran on ethanol. It was steered by a tiller. Was not much to look at, but the test drive was a success. Here's a poem for today by Heather Allen entitled Night in the Mountains. Gradually along the range, all things exchange their light for darkness. Single oaks on hills that burned with gold merge now in shadow. And hawks sail out over the valley, its air like a mirror filling with night that takes our images and does not return them. Just as the pines blot out our voices and even the stones at our feet fade from sight, now only the stars have eyes, and around us sounds of things we cannot see begin to rise, the owl's single note and the coyote's cry. A poem by Heather Allen, Night in the Mountains, from her collection Leaving a Shadow, published by Copper Canyon Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
I'm Jordan Nigro, and I'm a sustaining member of K2. I have listened to K2 my entire life. I grew up in Gustavus, so I think I was listening to K2 in the womb. Becoming a member felt sort of like a rite of passage and becoming a member of the community. It's not about the amount, it's about the connection.
Connect and contribute at ktoo.org.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Our next guest is Tom Rutecki from the NOAA Marine Fisheries Okbay Lab. Glad to have you here, Tom. We were just talking sharks before the mic came on, and you said there are 10 species in Alaska, one of which you're going to cut open on Friday. So give us a context here. Yeah. Tell us about the sharks and why this one is going under the knife.
There are 10 species that either occur episodically or live here year-round, and probably the one that everybody, you know, gets excited about is the great white. And they usually show up in, like, El Nino years, one of which is coming up here right now in 2014. And we've had them at our lab. Salmon trollers will catch one, you know, like 16 or 17 feet long when I first started working here. They'd bring the whole thing into the lab. The cool ones are that people probably don't even know about, and they're right here, right off of Point Retreat, are Pacific sleeper sharks that can get to 25 feet long. And their weight and length is almost kind of exponential. So, like, say one that's 8 feet long, one that's 9 feet long will weigh like 50% more. They have this just cool green eye, and so they're really common now. And 20 years ago, we never caught any of them. And then when we do our sablefish surveys, these guys started showing up, and so something's really good in the ocean for them. And right now we have our Sun to Sea NOAA Middle School Science Camp going on. We have middle school kids that we take on for 7 days and do activities that show them the relationship between the ocean and the atmosphere. We do it in conjunction with the National Weather Service and the Juneau Economic Development Council, their science, technology, their STEM program. And so as part of that, on Friday, we're going to dissect dogfish, which are a shark. During World War II, they were, you know, utilized for their oil and their livers. In Taku Smokeries, Eric Norman provided us with a half dozen. They're great because they actually live a long time. Some of them are like 50, 60 years old. All the organs are really big and easy to see, and they have live-bearing young, so the kids get all excited because there's, you know, live little baby sharks inside of them, as opposed to other fish that have eggs and stuff. So, there's blue sharks, basking sharks. There was one caught off a Yakutat that I think was like 30 feet long one year by a seiner, and they're a plankton eater. So, there's sharks in Alaska, and salmon sharks. People see those. They look kind of like a little miniature orca in a way. They're actually more like a little miniature great white. They're really cool. So, we have sharks.
So you're from the Midwest, from Michigan. What else surprised you when you came to this region of the country in terms of what's in the ocean here? I'm surprised by the numbers of species of sharks. What surprised you?
Just the diversity, because I grew up, I actually worked as a biologist on the Great Lakes. I went to grad school at the University of Michigan, and I dove a lot. I did my master's thesis. It was a study on artificial reefs, and I just remember the first time I went diving, it was just Okbay. I saw more things in the animal kingdom in 10 minutes than I did in 7 years in the Great Lakes. You know, there's just so much stuff, and there's so much color, and it's so cool. And, you know, Alaska has, especially out in the Aleutians, one of our projects at the lab, actually they're gearing up a boat to go to Tracy Arm's study coral. We have really extensive coral beds in the Aleutians, and there's some here in Windham Bay and Tracy Arm that are they're really important habitat. They're like sort of like trees that get 10 or 12 feet long. It's important habitat for juvenile rockfish, and it's easily damaged by longliners. They'll break just like breaking branches of a tree off, and then there's all sorts of littler corals and sponges out in the Aleutians that are just colorful and just amazing. So there's really a lot of stuff. Just well, for our camp this week, we went to a little tide pool by Aw Creek, and I think we got 8 different kinds of little fish, and there were like 20 different kinds of vertebrates. And this is just in a little what people call a puddle. You know, it's just all this stuff is just in there.
It's alive. So quite a bit of your job is doing outreach, Tom, for NOAA out at the lab. Tell me a little bit more about what that involves, and what if somebody's curiosity is piqued and they want to know more. So tell me what you do to help inform people, and what could just an individual do?
One of the things we do kind of along those lines is mentor science fair students. The Southeast Science Fair is really, I think it's its own nonprofit. It's really not part of the school district. And so kids, when they get to 9th grade, can do a science fair project, and they can do anything. I mean, some kids will bake a cake and compare 2 kinds of yeast. Others will look at, you know, bioluminescence and dinoflagellates and do some really complicated genetic stuff. So there's a wide range of things. And we usually get kids that want to do something in marine biology. So they contact us, and we take on a student. Usually, I think they have to spend at least 20 hours. So they actually plan an experiment. They have a null hypothesis. They have a lab logs are due every so often. And so we work with the kids. And then in March, they have, they put it all together and explain their project. And, you know, we try to do it where it doesn't really matter if your experiment, if you showed what you wanted to or not. It's just that you knew how to try to do it. And so that's one of the things we do. And we have like teachers at the lab. Bonita Nelson is an outreach person there, and she takes on teachers and tries to work with them every summer. We've gotten Holling Scholars, which are sophomores in college, that will come and work at the lab for the whole summer. We also do tours. I think it's open to anybody for adults. There's a contractor that gets hired to show people around the lab, we have this science on a sphere. There was one at the museum here. There is one, I guess, the museum. So we have one at our lab, and so that thing's pretty cool. It can do a lot of stuff, except we don't really have a really good place for viewing it, but it's still people come out and watch that. So.
And in case people don't know, the lab is out on Lena. I have one last question. You just have a moment to answer. Are we taking good care of our fish in this state?
Yeah, I think they're the best managed fish in the world. Actually, Bob Takach, who just passed away, I used to spend time in the pool sauna talking to him. And one of the topics was the sustainable fisheries designation that some, you know, your fish, your product can get. And it's really kind of a racket, the fact that they didn't want to certify Alaska fish. I mean, they don't even have half the fisheries back east that we have, and they're very well managed. And there's some people that might argue otherwise, but, I'm no expert on management, but there sure are a lot of, you know, people making a lot of money fishing, and they keep doing it year after year after year, and there's plenty of fish still.
Thanks, Tom. We've been talking with Tom Rutecki of the NOAA Lab, the Auk Bay Lab, which is actually out on Lena Loop. Join us tomorrow afternoon for Juno Afternoon. Shona Strasser hosts. We'll get an update on public library activities with Beth Weigel. We'll get details about this Saturday's Family Day at the Lake. John Ferringer will be here to highlight his 30-year retrospective, First Friday Show at Kales. We'll find out about the upcoming Whale Watch Cruise for the Bartlett Foundation. And Catherine Hatch will be here with Arts Up. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more tomorrow at 3. Thanks for joining us on Juno Afternoon. Increasing clouds and rain likely on the weekend. Thank you.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno.